Well, the lesson this afternoon will be a little different. It'll be more in a story format. And hopefully by the end of it, it will make a very personal application for where you are. Paul would remind us in Romans, the 15th chapter, that we should give honor to whom honor is due. And so this lesson was swiped from Max Lucado in one of his writings and speakings. He gives the storyline here, the contemporary storyline that I'm going to borrow for my lesson. And it began in a place much like our own, maybe in a land much like our own, and maybe even a neighborhood that you're familiar with. This particular neighborhood was a very fine neighborhood. They were very proud of their community. They kept the streets clean. They watered the lawn at appropriate times. They mowed the yard. They trimmed the yard, and then they cleaned everything up. They were very happy with their neighborhood. And they set some very high standards. Now, in this neighborhood, it was very unusual because every home had a family of four. There was a mom and dad and two children. And those two children either had a dog or a cat. And there was the mandatory goldfish bowl with one goldfish. And they would walk their dog on a regular basis. They would wave hi to the mailman to be kind. They turned out their lights at 10 o'clock. The whole neighborhood. Everybody just went to bed. It was a quiet, orderly way of life. But it was about to be changed. For you see, on the corner of Oak and Elm, a man bought the little brick house. Now, I don't know if you caught that, but a man bought the house. Not a family of four, not even a couple, but a man bought the house on the corner of Oak and Elm. His name was Levi. And Levi was different. Levi drove a Corvette. Not just any kind of Corvette. It was a red Corvette. And it had pipes on it. And it had a convertible top. And when he drove his Corvette, he liked to play that music really loud. Now, Levi did try to fit in the community somewhat. He did water his lawn and mow it and trim it. But he always did so with his shirt off. And then we need to talk about Levi's friends. They were from the seedier part of town. And this nice, quiet community was not real happy with him. Because to accommodate his friends, he installed a pool, and then he put an outdoor deck on, and then he added an outdoor kitchen, and then he realized he needed a really nice sound system. And his friends and Levi really liked to party. They partied long. They partied loud. And once again, things were just being turned upside down in this very fine, quiet neighborhood. Now, some of those people from the seedier side of town, they wore army boots. They had tattoos. They drove souped-up motorcycles, high-rider pickup trucks, low-riders. And I have to tell you about their women. Their women wore two tight tank tops. It was quite a sight. Some of the men had six-packs. And some of the men just carried the six-packs in. And it just went on and on. And on Sunday mornings, in this fine neighborhood, as they loaded their two children in their car, and they drove to church, They would go by the corner of Oak and Elm, and they'd look at the cans littered across the lawn, and they'd look at their children, and they would point to that little brick house, and they would say to their children, "This man needs Jesus." And one day Jesus came. I mean, really, Jesus came to the Vine neighborhood. He walked up and down the street, knocked on doors, trying to find somebody to have a conversation with. And you know, he couldn't find anybody to grill a hamburger on the barbecue or play a game of pool or just shoot the breeze. You know, because they all had schedules. They all had children that they had playing games. They had their appointments. They had to make sure the lawn was all taken care of. Nobody had time for Jesus in this Vine neighborhood except Levi. Levi had time for Jesus. And as surprising as it might seem, Levi and Jesus got along. They just shot the breeze. They began to laugh. And after a period of time, Levi began to share his sordid background with Jesus. And Jesus talked to Levi about forgiveness. And Levi asked, "There is forgiveness for someone just like me?" And Jesus said, "Yeah, especially for someone like you." And so our story now turns, and we go to Luke, the 5th chapter, to see the real story and learn some lessons from Levi. Luke, the 5th chapter. Jesus and Levi meet. Verses 27 and 28. We're going to kind of go through this little story a couple of verses at a time. Later on, as Jesus left the town, he saw a tax collector with the usual reputation for cheating sitting at a tax collection booth. The man's name was Levi, and Jesus said to him, "Come and be one of my disciples." So Levi left everything, sprang up, and went with him. There are a couple of things we need to know. First of all, Levi was also known as Matthew. And before Levi was an apostle, before Levi was a follower of Christ, before Levi was the writer of the Gospel of Matthew, before Levi was a martyr for Christ, he was the antithesis of a law-abiding, synagogue-going, God-fearing child of Abraham. He was a tax collector. He was a turncoat. He was a snitch. He was not someone you wanted to deal with. And somewhere along the line, he and Jesus crossed paths in this story. And Jesus somehow saw potential in Matthew. And Matthew evidently saw forgiveness and hope in Jesus. And so he joined this ragtag group of disciples, just a group of guys going through the countryside. But you know, if we kind of imagine the story, if we try to think about Levi's world, you know, it probably would have been hard to leave some of those friends. You know, he probably really liked them. There was something about them. He probably knew that their language was a little salty, their morals were sleazy, but there was something about Billy Bob and Bubba Joe that just kind of made him laugh. He just kind of liked them. And so Jesus had this idea. He said, "Hey, why don't we just have a party? You throw a party for all your new friends and for your old friends. And that way we can get everybody together." And so, in verse 29, it says, "Levi gave a large dinner party at his home for Jesus. Everybody was there. Taxmen and other seedy characters as guests at the dinner. And can you imagine Levi's joy at being able to share what he had just found? I bet he was so intent on making this dinner party one of the best that ever happened that year. Maybe the best in the decade. So I'm sure he ordered the very best foods, that he had the best wine, that he made sure there were plenty of people to serve his guest. He had it all laid out so that people could understand what he had found. And if we're trying to describe that kind of party in today's vernacular, we'd say that was a party of bikes, babes, and Bibles. I mean, they were all kind of joined together, coming together. And, you know, Jesus loved it. But the religious leaders weren't so thrilled about it. They'd heard about the rubbing of the shoulders. And what does a good religious leader do when there's something going on that he thinks shouldn't happen and he hasn't been invited to it? Well, you crash it, of course. So look at verse 30. The Pharisees and their religion scholars came to his disciples greatly offended. What is he doing, eating and drinking with cooks, crooks, and sinners? Well, that's kind of interesting to start with. Aren't we told that if we have a problem, we're supposed to go directly to someone? Why didn't they go to Jesus? Why didn't they ask Jesus that question? He was the one that was doing this. Well, let's give the Pharisees a little space. You know, Jesus may have been in the middle of all those crooks and sinners, you know, and maybe they didn't want to soil themselves. So they didn't go in. Okay, I can understand that. But what were his disciples doing then? They must have been in the outside periphery. They must have been not quite sure what to do either. So they were the ones that the Pharisees ran across and asked these questions. So what is it about the Pharisees then that made them this way? Well, when we begin to look at the term Pharisee and how it lines up, it really comes down to ideas like to be separate, or to cloister, or to quarantine, or to isolate. And that's really what the Pharisees were about, wasn't it? We got to isolate ourselves, keep ourselves pure and holy. You know, if you let the good apples touch a bad apple, pretty soon you're going to have all the good apples be bad apples. And so they were separate. And it probably is a message that Levi and his friends had heard before, wasn't it? They already knew that they weren't good enough to even come into the synagogue, let alone the temple. They weren't welcome in the places where religion was taking place. So just another experience in hundreds of other experiences. And maybe they started to pack up. Maybe they just started to say, well, this is it. We'll just leave. We've heard it all before. We know it's just best to just move on out and not argue about it. But Jesus wasn't finished. Jesus wasn't giving up that easy. Look in verses 31 and 32. Jesus answered them, the Pharisees, "It is the sick who need a doctor, not those in good health. My purpose is to invite sinners to turn from their sins, not to spend my time with those who think themselves already good enough." He said, "I'm not interested in those people that think they got it all together. I'm interested in people who know they don't have it all together. Those are the people I want to talk to. And so, that's where we're going to turn the story now and think about its application for us. Do you know any Levites? Your personal Levites? People that are not many me's. You know, they talk like me, they look like me, they believe the same things I do. Many me's. People I'm really comfortable with. Or do you have some Levites in your life? People that are really different. You don't quite know what to do with. And where could we find those? Could it be a welfare recipient? An uptight Republican? A tobacco-chewing survivalist? A bleeding-heart Democrat? A tree-hugging environmentalist? A Bible-thumping fundamentalist? Someone that drives a hybrid versus someone who drives a jacked-up pickup that gets 4 miles to the gallon? Or could it even be a lady who loves her husband versus a lady who loves her wife? There are Levites all around us. And how we respond to them is critically important. How do I deal with someone that I just don't understand? Do I ignore them? Do I just turn them off? Do I share a meal with them or do I just dismiss them? Do I engage them or do I attack them? Do I discuss our differences? Do I argue? And the problem is, in many of our lives, it can be that our Levites, my opposite me's, may be really close. They could be my boss. They could be a coworker. They could be your neighbor. They could be one of your own children. Or they could be your parent. Or they could be that person 3 rows up and just a little to the right. We have them around us. What do we do with them? How do we interact with them? Well, let's look at Romans 15 then. One verse in particular there that we're going to focus on, just that one sentence about how to deal with our Levites, our opposite me's. And in Romans 15, starting with and looking at verse 7, the first part of that says, therefore, accept each other. Okay? Accept each other. Well, what does the word accept mean? Well, it means don't dismiss or don't deny. Yeah? That's not much help, is it? So, evidently, we need to figure out what accept means, because my definition of acceptance may be quite different than your definition of acceptance. And I may take exception to your acceptance. So I kind of need to know what I'm talking about. Well, let's look back at that verse again. Therefore, accept each other in the same way. Okay, this is going to give me a clue now, isn't it? In the same way that Christ accepted you. He did this to bring glory to God. So how did Christ accept me? How did Christ accept me? He took me right where I was, didn't he? Not as a finished project, but as a project. He understood that I had things to get through. He accepted me, but not my behavior. He could have accepted me, but not my drinking. He would accept me, but not my promiscuity. He would accept me, but not my stealing. He would accept me and not me thinking I'm good enough already. Well, you see, we can't be good enough or bad enough for Christ to accept us to start the process. He accepted what I could become if I chose, so chose. And Paul says, I want you to accept each other in the same way. What they can become. He didn't say, I want you to clean up first and then I'll accept you. He said, I'll take you first and clean you up and then we'll work on what goes. And that's quite a bit different. In John 1 and 14, we're told that Jesus came full of grace and truth. Two very mysterious words, two very powerful words, grace and truth. Grace told the adulterous woman that was brought to him, I do not condemn you. Truth said, go and sin no more. Grace invited Zacchaeus to lunch. Truth inspired him to give over half of his goods to the poor. Grace invited Peter to walk on the water. Truth upbraided him when he didn't have enough faith to stay on top of the water. Grace invited the woman at the well to drink a living water. Truth told her, well, the man you're with is not your husband because you've already had five husbands and you're just simply shacking up with this one. Grace met Nicodemus at night. Truth told him that if he wanted to see the kingdom of God, he needed to be born again. Jesus shared grace truthfully and truth graciously. They are a combination. They cannot be overlooked. If we offer only grace to someone and we gloss over the truth, we miss the point because Jesus would say, it is truth that sets you free. If all we offer is truth and we do not include grace, we miss the point where it says, by grace are you saved. Truth and grace, as we deal with other people, need to be a part of what we come. We need to find that balance between grace and truth. And this is something that I've had to learn over the years. I can remember from this pulpit, in my youth, coming loaded with my double-barrel shotgun full of truth and blasting away. It didn't have much grace in it. It didn't really accomplish much. And through the years, I've seen the value of including grace with the truth that's there. So how do we interact with our opposite me? How do we show grace and truth? Well, I'd like to share 3 points with you as we get ready to close this down from the story of Levi. That how we can deal with those that we find ourselves opposed to, on the opposite end of the spectrum with. Number one, learn the story of your Levi. That means you need to ask questions. You need to ask questions like, can you explain to me about what it is, what it's like to be a teenager today? You know, because that's nothing like when I was a teenager. What's it like to just help me understand? Can you explain to me? Can you help me understand what it's like to be a single mom raising three or four kids? What is that process? Can you help me understand what it's like to be an immigrant? Can you help me understand what it's like to be in charge of 10, 20, or 100 people? Can you help me understand what it's like to have gone through an abortion? You see, in order to ask those questions, there's one critical thing we need to do. We need to shut up. We need to not be busy trying to come up with a reason why. We just need to listen to what's going on. Because we don't know what's going on. We had a young man at our congregation that used to say, "You only know what you know, and you don't know what you don't know." It's very good. We make assumptions about people's actions and activities and attitudes all the time where we have no clue where they've been or what's going on. We only know what we know, and we don't know what we don't know. And that happens when we choose to listen. So listen to your Levi, first of all. Understand their story. Peter would say in 1 Peter 4:8, "Be in agreement, understanding each other as family, being kind and humble." Kind and humble. The second thing is to resist the urge to shout. Because if you're listening to a Levi story, I'm sure at least one time through their story, your initial reaction is going to be, "What in the world were you thinking?" Because it's so clear to us. And of course, if you shout that, you just shut down your Levi. So we need to resist that. Sometimes it does feel good to shout at somebody, but it doesn't really accomplish very much. If you think about it, if you have somebody that's shouting at you, either physically shouting or they're emotionally shouting, in other words, they got their finger in your chest and they're saying, "What are you doing? When are you going to change? How are you going to get that done? Are we thinking about what we're going to do or change or get it done? Or are we thinking about how to break their finger?" We need to not shout. Because the reality is, when you stop to think about it, our reaction to shout is because we're uncomfortable. They're not uncomfortable. They know their story. We're the ones that are uncomfortable. Paul would say in 1 Timothy 6:4, "Be careful of the person who is full of pride and understands nothing, but is in love for arguing and fighting about words." Oh, listen to that. I love this translation of that verse. "Be careful of the person who is full of pride and understands nothing, but is sick with the love for arguing and fighting about words. This brings about jealousy, fighting, and speaking against each other." We need to not shout. We need to listen. Learn the story of your Levi. Help to understand them. Resist the urge to shout. And then finally, at the same time, we need to be clear about our own convictions. That's important. We need to know how grace and truth blend together. Peter would say in 1 Peter 3:15-16, "Instead, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. And if someone asks you about your Christian hope, always be ready to explain it. But do this in a gentle and respectful way." Keep your conscience clear. Then if people speak against you, they will be ashamed when they see what a good life you live because you belong to Christ. Understanding how important it is to have our conviction, but to do it in a way that makes sense, that shows respect. I'm pretty sure I've shared this story before here and at other places I know. When I was getting my counseling degree, one of my classes was called group therapy. And what that meant was about 20 of us sat in a circle in a room and we just talked about whatever was on our mind. We just talked, da, 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 da. I thought it was kind of a silly class, but it was a class I needed to take, so we went through it. But one of the assignments in the class was that you had to have a conversation with someone that you didn't know from that class. Well, during our introductions, now this was back in early 80s. It's a long time ago. There was a man who was a minister in a religious organization. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was like Presbyterian or something. And he was homosexual. And he admitted that to the group. This is in the 80s, way before it was okay. So that was quite a step for him. But I chose him to talk to. I made the appointment with him because I wanted to hear from someone who said they were a believer and yet thought homosexuality was okay. I just needed to know. And so he and I had lunch together. And I listened to his sentences. I listened to his arguments. And at the end, I still wasn't convinced. I didn't think he knew what he talked about. I didn't necessarily tell him that, but I told him we're just in a disagreement. So we come to a disagreement there. You see the Apostle Paul in a much different way than I see the Apostle Paul. It's just not working. But we were in class together. Toward the end of that class, he made an announcement that he had found a liaison down in Arizona somewhere with a Catholic priest. And he was going to go down to visit this Catholic priest. And so people began going all the way around the class, giving him congratulations, hope it all goes great, hope you find true love, very accepting counseling. Until it came to me. And because we had had that conversation, I could say to him face to face, you know that I cannot wish you the best in that mood. Now, that didn't make me very popular with the rest of the counseling group. But he understood because I had had that conversation. We need to know that as we talk with people, we need to understand their story. We need to resist the urge to shout. And then at the same time, we need to be very clear about our own personal convictions, but in a way that keeps us going. Learn the story, resist shouting, and be clear. That's kind of a summation then. In a book called Streams of Mercy by Mark Rutland, there was a survey made of statements we like to hear. And he commented on the three statements were the top statements that we like to hear. So what statements do you think we like to hear? What would you guess? Good job. I love you. That was actually number one. I love you was number one. It's a thing we like. Do what? Yeah, here's the money I owe you. Here's the money I owe you. Yeah. That'd be great in there, but I'm not sure it ever showed up. Yeah. I love you was the first one. I forgive you was the second one. Or it's okay. We can work it out. I forgive you. The third one was a surprise. Nobody guessed it. And the third one was, supper's ready. And I love that. I love those three phrases. Because that, in essence, is what we present to people. Jesus loved us. He's forgiven us. And He has made it so that supper's ready. In all of our lives, and all that we do to touch our Levites, those are the three things we can share with them. That Jesus loves them. He's forgiven them. And there is a supper feast waiting for those that are willing to accept that love and forgiveness. May we recognize that in ourselves and understand how valuable that is. If there's anything that you would like to share with the body, we'll give you that opportunity now as we stand and as we sing.